Welcome to the Gambling Files podcast, the podcast that eats its young. Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files. I think this is episode 70. Which means it is the start of season two, because we, like so many media outlets, we have 69 episodes in a season as a tribute to, of course, Bill and Ted. I'm John Bruford. I'm joined by my co-host, Clinton. Hello.
Hi, John.
What's wrong?
Nothing. I'm fine. It's all good.
You know, everybody loves Bill and Ted, don't they?
They do. Stay excellent.
Do they say stay excellent?
Stay excellent to each other? Isn't that their thing?
Be excellent to each other.
Be excellent to each other. Okay. Apologies. Yeah. It's been a while.
Have you got a favorite Bill and Ted film?
There was only one. Was it Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure?
Fucking hell, Fintan. There are three.
You see, yeah,
You're missing out on some great stuff. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which obviously is fabulous. Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
Oh, yeah.
And Bill and Ted Face the Music, which came out 18 months ago.
Okay. I haven't seen that one.
It's worth a watch. It maintains the spirit.
Your ability to recall movies and actors is utterly phenomenal.
It's really genuinely not. And I find myself more and more having to look shit up. But
everything's relevant, relative, John, because compared to me, your skills are just
Yeah, but
amazing.
If you met my mate Toby, Toby has made his career out of being a fan of Doctor Who.
Okay.
Right, we were at school together. And he's a lovely guy, and he finished university in Manchester, has become an actor, but to pay the bills, he became a comedian and actor, and he wrote an autobiographical show called Moths Ate My Doctor Who Scarf. And it was about growing up as a Doctor Who fan when it wasn't cool. And it's really, really lovely. It's really good. And he's been all over the world and performed it, because nice. There are Who fans everywhere. And, but he's got like loads of different, he does loads of podcasts. He does commentaries on, you know, old Doctor Who episodes for BBC. You know, he's a real serious authority on it. And he's one of those guys where if you talk to him about a British actors particularly, you talk to him about a British actor, he not only knows all their credits and their relation to everybody else, he knows their theatre credits as well. But what he did when we were growing up is he would find out their agent or whatever, and he'd just write letters to people. He'd write letters to people that had been in Doctor Who, and he would begin correspondence with them.
Wow.
Which, you know, it's just a tremendously lovely way to do things. He's a lovely guy. But it is an absolutely lovely way to do things.
He will
text me occasionally when he makes a connection with somebody that we both think is awesome. He sent me a picture a little while ago because Edgar Wright, you know, the guy that directed Shaun of the Dead, etc., had started following him on Twitter.
Nice.
And he's been writing a book for as long as I've known him, which is 35 years. He's been writing the definitive book on the old Quatermass show. And a couple of years ago, he learned that John Carpenter, legendary director, Carpenter's a massive Quatermass fan, and he interviewed Carpenter. And I got a text that day. He's like, "You never guess who I'm about to call. John Carpenter." And I'm like, holy fucking shit. How the hell did we get into this?
No idea, mate. I just kind of set you off and you just kind of run with it, really.
Jesus, sorry about that. I don't know what.
It makes co-hosting very easy.
But Toby's a bit of a legend. He's the pinnacle of that storing information. He's also highly intelligent. I mean, that probably helps. Whereas I'm just, you know, skating by at best.
Fair enough.
So what have you been up to?
Smashing through my New Year's resolutions.
Oh, yeah?
Getting momentum, as I like to call it.
It's only the fucking 11th of January, Fintan. I mean, it's only the 12th of January, Fintan, because, you know, we're putting this out tomorrow.
So I had a man with a drill in to install my pull-up bar. That was
not a euphemism, folks.
Not definitely not a euphemism. He had a very big drill. That was a bit more complicated than I realized. I thought it was just, you know, bash some holes in the ceiling and off we go kind of thing. But
have you got upstairs neighbors?
We do, but I've got a storeroom in the basement. So we've got our apartment block's got an underground car park and we've got little storerooms. The Dutch are great for stuff like this.
Jesus.
Oh, it's amazing.
It's very sensible.
So I've cleared out the little storeroom because we just a lot of crap accumulates in there. And so that was project one. And then project two was get the man to show up with the drill and fit my new hanging from the ceiling pull-up bar. But he didn't have the right fixings, or the fixings I had were the wrong ones. And so he had to go off and get fixings and come back and then not hit the metal beams in the concrete and not.
Yeah, Christ.
Other stuff. And get it installed. That's great. I'm on my training plan for running. That's going well.
About 18 months ago, I got a mirror and a disabled handrail installed in the garage.
Nice.
But the handrail's there for doing resistance band stuff with. And at the moment, you can't even see it. There's that much shit in there.
It's a clothes horse, isn't it? Just stuff hanging off it.
I don't take stuff in the garage. I don't take my clothes into the garage, Fintan.
I'm sorry. I don't know what you do in your house.
Sorry. You're a modern apartment dweller in a city.
Yes. What do I know about housing? In a very expensive city for property, by the way. Very expensive.
I'm pretty sure they all are.
Amsterdam's definitely up there.
Well, then it's an investment, Fintan.
That's what the state agent tells you. Anyway.
I am one of those people where if I were ever in a position to buy a house, let's be realistic, not happening. But if I were, what I would try and do is buy a house that I wanted to live in. And that's pretty much where my thinking about it would end.
That's pretty much the goal though, right?
But you get a lot of people who are like, well, we're on the housing ladder. So, you know, then we'll look for something a bit bigger. But blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, I've never owned property. I've always rented. And there's a lot of upside to that. But then the downside is like, I'm in my 40s and I don't own a house. So there's a bit of, it would be nice to have your own place. I'm getting to that point. But then do I really want to play? Like, because the problem is you look at, say, stuff in Amsterdam and then you look at, okay, what would that get me in Portugal? And then you're like, oh my God. So I really need my son to fucking just hurry up and get through school so we can fucking crack on out of here and go somewhere sunny.
I think, anybody can do that. I mean, it's quite interesting. When you have a sort of a densely populated place where the property is considerably more expensive than elsewhere, it can create massive inequalities elsewhere in the country. And so where I grew up in Ludlow, you know, it's generally considered one of the most beautiful towns in England for good reason. It is. But what you get people moving there from, you know, fucking St. Albans or Richmond. And some of my friends have in fact moved there from St. Albans and Richmond. And they buy a house because they've sold their place for $750,000. And they've looked at what you can get in Ludlow for that. And you can get a beautiful townhouse with a fucking 4-acre garden for not even half. And, you know, so the house prices stay up here. The average salary in Ludlow is
very, very low.
The division between have and have not is massive, but also what you also find is that people very often will buy a rental property. And I think I'm remembering this correctly. In the UK, if you buy a rental property and you get a buy-to-let mortgage, unlike my old landlords who didn't bother and thus defrauded their insurers and both their mortgage lenders. Swat. Still, lovely couple. My ass. Anyway, your rent has to hit 120% of your mortgage repayment, if I remember correctly. And so there's this enormous sort of stress on rents, which, you know, like, because you always think, like, if I were, like, if everything was stable and I was earning, maybe I'd buy a rental property and I buy a rental property and maybe charge, say, 500 quid a month for it. That'd be great, but my mortgage would be 750, but I'll put the 250 in and then there's 500 quid of equity going in there and as I'm just, you can't do that.
Yeah, I could never imagine anything worse than being a landlord. Of like,
but that the way that society is going in the UK is a division between owners and renters, and it's a big division. It's not like, because the difference between the UK and that 120% figure is the UK has no fucking rent protection at all. I lived in a place when I was 21. Right, this is a fucking shit idea of mine. I took a job that paid next to nothing in. Where was it? Newton Abbot in Devon. And I was living in Torquay. And one of my close friends had recently committed suicide and he threw himself off a multi-story car park, but he did it like properly. He threw himself off a multi-story car park and landed in front of a bus.
Oh, so wow.
You know what? If this doesn't go right, I'm still good. And I moved into this basement apartment in Torquay. And it was in an area that was rough as assholes. And the basement apartment, only windows at the back, a wall of windows at the back, looked out on a multi-story car park. I mean, that's all I could see. I could not have lived anywhere more depressing. I had a neighbor who never saw daylight, also never brushed his teeth, but somehow the ladies loved him. How does that even work?
But that's bizarre.
Anyway. So I was working for this dude, Mark, who, you know, we're now friends, luckily. And it went south and there was a disagreement and he fired me. Fair enough. He did rehire me a couple of years later. But when he fired me, I had to claim unemployment and get rent support, right? Well, the rent support that I got was... about £30 a week less than my actual rent. And so the living allowance that I got all went on completing the rent payment. So I had, it was about £3.65 a week to actually live on. It's interesting, you know, turns out people throw away a lot of good food. And if you're in a party town, you can generally find a kebab or a burger sitting on a fence somewhere of a morning.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, if you're up early enough. But you know what I mean? It was grim, but that's what happens when you don't have any kind of rent protection.
Yeah, it's the Europeans get this. Like Ireland's the same issue as the UK. Like my younger brothers had huge issues over Christmas. But the Europeans just get it right. Like we're completely controlled in terms of how much they can put up the rent every year and just that's it. And as long as I pay the rent, they can't kick me out. And then I can decorate and do whatever I need in the property. Totally fine. Apart from I can't touch the bathroom. But then if I've got a problem, they'll just fix it the next day kind of thing. So
when in the 80s, the Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister, her government sold off a huge amount of social housing, which, you know, was great for the people that bought it. And some lovely houses were out there and on the market. And it helped the economy grow, and lending was huge because people got mortgages, and you know, you had that artificial bubble created by housing that happens in a capitalist economy. But it's a very, very fragile bubble. But they didn't replace the social housing. So what you have now is a huge gap in social housing and no rent controls and a cost of living crisis that is, it's not, people aren't tumbling into poverty. People are being fucking stamped into poverty. And it's, yeah, it's a bit shit.
Yeah.
A lot of things are coming together. It's not just things that are happening now. This is things that have happened, you know, decades ago. And it's just all coming to roost together.
Yeah. And Rishi's going to solve it all by making kids study maths until they're 18.
Yeah. Fintan is, of course, referring to our beloved insect overlord's proclamation that we need to study more maths, which is a great way to prove to the electorate that you're not a twat.
But what I don't, but the thing is, I think the UK is one of the few places where, like, you actually can stop studying certain subjects at a pretty young age. Like, okay, I can kind of get the maths backlash to a degree, but the fact that teenagers aren't studying English, maths, and probably a foreign language or something all the way up until they start university is a shock. Like, the UK A-level system, I think, is a pile of shite. Like, it's just doesn't make sense. Like, you get, like, y'all see CVs where, like, their A-level was in, like, PE.
I wish I'd done PE.
Which is physical education for the American listeners. Basically, gym class was their, you know, subject.
Did you do A-levels?
I did the Irish system, so we have the Leaving Cert. So in the Leaving Cert, you've got to do, so the way the Irish system is, you've got to do English, Irish, maths, and a foreign language. So that's your core subjects. And then on top of that, you've got to do, I think, four more subjects. So I'd have done like business studies, economics, physics, biology.
Yeah, all the easy shit.
It took me a couple of goes. Didn't get a first try. took a second stab at that. And but so your core education, and then like those, there's higher and ordinary levels. So there's different levels to it. But the higher level is basically the, like, for example, my economics that I did a business degree, but my high school economics was the equivalent of first year university type stuff. So it's to a very high standard.
So it's like a foundation year.
Yeah, but I also think I think where the Americans get it right with universities is that more kind of first couple of years, it's more like an arts degree. So it's more kind of general. You do a lot of different subjects, you try a lot of stuff, and then you I think in the UK, like, you basically end up specializing at 15. In most countries, you end up specializing when you start university because you've got to pick your university subject. But I do think the American system, where it's a couple of years of just a more general, like, everybody should study poetry and literature. And I think that, you know, I think everybody should study the arts. Regardless of, like, you want to be a doctor, you want to be a lawyer, you want to be whatever. I think there's so much benefit for a lot of these subjects as just a general education.
This might shock you, but my career in further education wasn't great.
Not surprised.
It was around that period where I think I realized that I was an unemployable lone wolf. Exactly. But I did A-levels. I had to retake my maths GCSE. And so I think I took a photography GCSE as well, just to like fill that up. And I started doing an English A-level. And then I realized that I would have to read D.H. Lawrence. And I just can't stand D.H. Lawrence. The idea of doing that for a year, it's like, no, I'm good, thanks. I could have done it. I could have faked it, but I would have really hated it. So I did media studies and theatre studies, two things that I find quite interesting. And what happened was I got, for both of those, I got the top marks in my year. I got top or second marks in my entire year for the practical assessment.
Mm.
And then I completely fucked the exam and I wound up getting D's. That's how badly I did in the exams. And I think it's fair to say that an academic learning setup, it might be something I'm not best suited to.
But I also think that that's where a lot of system, like the particularly the UK and the Irish system go, like, you know, it's designed for everybody's got to go to university. Where I think the, you know, not everybody should go to university. Some of the richest people I know did trades and are hugely successful. Like, I think there should just be giving the kids to look, do something a bit more practical. There's tons of opportunities and things you could do. And I think the, again, without banging on about, I think the European system of like apprenticeships and trades and trade school and those types of things. And it's just like my son's, like, we're in the process now of he'll be going to secondary school next year. And he's got some exams and stuff coming up. And there's a very clear streaming system based on the exams and kind of his long-term type stuff. And there's some great options regardless of what he gets in the exams. And I think that's really important too. But anyway.
Hey.
Cool.
Next week.
Yeah.
As well as having our new sponsors on. I think I'm going to be talking about some of the new shit I'm working on.
Oh, finally.
Maybe.
Because it's tough. Because I don't know what I'm allowed to say, what I'm not allowed to say, what am I meant to know, what am I not meant to know. I'm not designed for subterfuge, John. I'm an open book.
I hear you. But great. Yeah.
Looking forward to it. And talking of podcasts, who have we got on the podcast this week, John?
That is a really good question.
We've got Jesse Learmonth.
Learmonth.
That's what I said.
You said Learmonth.
I'm Irish. That's just.
Don't pretend it's your accent.
It's a TH thing. I struggle with THs. 33 and a third. Hey. We've got Jesse on. He runs the absolutely excellent, and you should totally listen to it, Gambling Startups podcast, where he interviews gambling startups. He's up to 50 episodes now. Really, really good ones. Recent one with the guy from Better, which is the Jake Paul micro betting. It's not Jake Paul on, but that'd be great for the record. That would be great for the numbers, wouldn't it? But the actual CEO doing the hard work. So Jesse's on talking about his podcast. He gave myself and John some tips on how we can professionalize. Jesse's also launched his new jobs board for the gambling industry, bettingrolls.com, and where he's aggregating all of the available jobs. And I think that was also great, or it is great. It was really interesting. And yeah, we had a really good chat with Jesse and we ended up talking about our favorite Canadians.
It's a big list.
It's a big list.
Jesse was reticent about his favorite Canadians, but I mean, I just jumped in there.
I thought you were more Canadian than he was. It was a bit.
I feel quite Canadian some days.
Yeah.
Hmm. But anyway.
Anyway.
Here's Jesse. Moving to join our guest for this episode, we are joined by the fabulously patient and forgiving Jesse Learmonth. Jesse is the host of the Betting Startups podcast, a podcast that Fintan is a big fan of. And I have to make an apology. I don't have to, but I'm going to. We actually did a recording with Jesse 4 months ago, 5 months ago.
August, I think it was.
And I lost the it fell through the cracks. And I'm sure anybody out there that's listening to this that knows me is aware that there are some big cracks in my head. You know, it was possibly around the time I fainted and cracked my head open.
No, it was long before that.
Yeah, it's... but that might have been the point at which I lost it. So maybe I was thinking about it when I fainted and that's why it went.
Well, obviously, long-term listeners know this is a well-oiled, scripted machine.
Scripted.
So they are clearly horrified that anything could possibly go wrong behind the scenes.
Very rare.
Just like I've had to flog John, he's been reprimanded, he's on a performance improvement plan.
That's why Fenton's the chairman and I'm unemployable.
It's the whole thing. I've had to pip him in HR terms.
Pip?
A performance improvement plan. So it's the step you need to take before you're legally allowed to sack somebody in a lot of countries.
Wow.
So you've got to show as an employer that you've really tried and this person's just not suitable for the role. That's called a pip. In technical terms. So you've been pipped.
This is what chairmen know.
It's one of my superpowers.
I've probably been in situations where I could have done with a good pipping.
You probably haven't even realized you're being pipped. it's just happening all around you.
So I'm not sure. I don't know if that's a thing in the UK.
It's...
Maybe it has a different name.
Oh. It is a very American name, but yeah, like it's all kind of like, yeah.
I got put on gardening leave once.
Nice.
I might try and get the chap that did that on the podcast because he's a very interesting guy. But when I found out why at a later date, apparently him and the owner thought I was going to beat them up. I'm like, if I was going to do that, sacking me is not going to fucking save you, is it? I mean, I know where you work.
I've never managed to pull the gardening leave.
I only got a month.
No,
I
nobody's
spent
ever
that
given
month
a
drunk though.
No one's ever given a shit. Just like, yeah, fuck off. See you later. Never got the no. You're too important. We need to bench you for 6 months.
I think it was the timing of it was I'd been working there for just under 12 months. And at 12 months, all sorts of rights and shit kick in, or they did at that time. And I think they realized that I'm going to put this as politely as I can towards myself. I think they realized that I was a little too much for their management skills.
Unemployable, I think is the word you're looking for.
Unemployable. And you know, it was for the best because that was a job where I actually managed to burn out and I burned out there in less than a year.
Wow.
So that's the workload that I was doing there. It's good times, good times. But anyway, we're not here to talk about me, Fenton.
No, we're not.
As much as you might keep steering the conversation back to me, we're here to speak to Jesse about his awesome podcast.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Jesse's, and I'm delighted to get him back on again.
Should I change the theme tune to perhaps something by Rick Springfield or similar? Jesse's Girl.
Funny story on that. So I got married last year, and in preparations and
it's
planning,
it's barely funny now.
Well, it's hilarious now because it actually happened. You know, it was touch and go there for a minute, but you know, the band that we had hired for the wedding to play the evening, you know, they sat down with us, you know, organizing it all and said, "Hey, you know, what do you want to hear? What's the audience like?" So we kind of went through it and I said, "Guys, I really defer to your judgment. I really only have one ask for you, which is do not fucking play Jesse's Girl by Rick Springfield. That's my only requirement for the night tonight." So
that is some good forward thinking.
It's very good.
You know it's coming.
And it just,
as soon
you know,
as they're like, "Oh, who's made the booking? We can play."
Yeah.
We used to do a thing when my band used to play. We used to do a thing. This is so shit. I can't believe I'm saying this out loud on something that somebody might listen to one day. Luckily, we know better. I used to do a thing. I used to like stop the band doing whatever they do. Stop. Is there anybody called Hazel in the audience? And there never was. It's a relatively uncommon name. But one night there was somebody, and we did Purple Hazel by Jimi Hendrix.
And when you stopped everything and asked, was there a Hazel? And there's like crickets. Then what did you do?
We did Purple Haze, very different song.
Got it.
But we also did, and we did this song every, God, this is going to sound so bizarre. It was the early 90s. You could get away with more. We covered a Police song. You know Roxanne?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a pretty famous song, right?
Yeah.
Well, you can sort of speed it up and it's quite naturally got a sort of ska thing going on. More obvious when it's speeded up. And we sped it right up and I did it in a oh God. I did it in a Scottish falsetto. Roxanne! You definitely have to put on the red leg.
And the music career never took off.
I know, right?
Really?
In all seriousness, we were invited to play a showcase in front of record companies by another band. I think it was to make them look better afterwards.
It's like the comedian has got the really shitty warm-up act.
Yeah. Exactly. God,
just get out there and bomb.
The main act was brilliant, wasn't it? So, Jesse, what's your podcast about?
Well, it's a real abstract title, I know, so it leaves a lot to the imagination.
Seriously?
Yeah. Well, if you're asking sincerely, no, I chat with founders and CEOs of, you know, early stage companies in the ecosystem, in the industry that are doing interesting things, and really asking them questions, mostly because I'm curious and what they're up to. And I like kind of seeing the next great thing that's coming up. And sort of through that, I've talked to 55 of them now as of this moment. And yeah, we have a fun time, and it's been great, I think, to, you know, give the entrepreneurs a platform as well to tell their stories. So that's it in a nutshell. I'm also unemployable. So podcasting, I realize there's actually no credentials required to do that. Unless you have $89 for a microphone on Amazon, which I luckily did. And here we are.
What a club we are. what's the frequency of the podcast?
Yeah, so we launched it in November 2021, just over a year ago now. And I'll answer your question in a second here, John. But essentially, when I started it, I had no real goals or objectives or ambition per se, other than I wanted to challenge myself to try and get to 50 episodes, right? I you know, just being consistent with the content creation and production. Thought I'd try and get to 50. So I got to 50 quite recently. And I guess, yeah, with the weekly episodes, it's just over a year now. So here we are. And, you know, we still have a queue of something like 4 months worth of guests ahead of us here. So evidently there's no shortage of entrepreneurs trying to have a crack at things in the industry here.
Wow. 4 months queued up. We just make it up every week.
We're looking to be 4 hours ahead.
Seriously. If we talk to somebody in the wrong time zone, we actually lose an episode.
Which is one of the reasons I want to bring Jesse on, because he's super structured and he's super organized. And I think just if a little bit of that magic rubbed off on us as well, I think we could, and I'm really talking about you, John, I think this could be really good for us.
Yeah, Jesse, if you wouldn't mind just rubbing against me for a bit, that'd be great. I believe the legal term for that is frottage. And no need for a euphemism.
Well, that's a first. So,
Jesse, you've got a great voice for podcasting.
He does. He does. He's got a great voice for it. So all these entrepreneurs, all trying to crack the gambling industry. Who's obviously they're all your favorite and they're all going to be a huge success. But if you had to pick one as somebody who really stands out as, wow, this was really special, who would you have picked?
Oof. Yeah, way to put me on the spot there right out of the gate here, Fintan. Well, I do like them all equally. It's my Canadian answer, right? They're diplomatic. No, look, my memory's shot here, so I can only really go with the recency effect. I can only really remember the last three or four people I've talked to. So I guess with that as my caveat, let's see, a little while ago, we talked with a guy called Colin Davey from a company called BetScope. I actually met Colin a few months ago in Vegas at G2E. he was one of the five entrepreneurs that was pitching at the, I think it was called the Innovation Challenge at G2E. So one of the five startups that was pitching. He won unanimously the judge's vote that day. And he is an incredibly impressive entrepreneur. His very interesting sort of unique story is that his background is as a, I guess, you know, machine learning guy, data scientist, smart stuff that I'll never be good at if I live to be 1,000 years old, but really smart stuff. And he told this story in his pitch of how he applied data science to basically learn all of the answers to Jeopardy, the game show, because he was invited on to Jeopardy. And he realized in that moment that he didn't actually have the breadth of knowledge required to perhaps succeed at Jeopardy. So yeah, he told the story of applying his data science, knowledge to the whole corpus of information out there. And basically he hacked Jeopardy and ended up winning an episode. That obviously isn't related to his startup, but I think it sort of went to show as an example how sort of clever, you know, a clever application of data science could really be used. And, you know, looking at his company, BetScope, they're doing some very interesting stuff with data analytics and really, I think, simplifying data analytics for people that are betting on sports, right? And obviously, there's a lot of those people right now that are getting introduced to data and sort of statistical analysis for the first time. Obviously, a very steep learning curve for something like that. And some of the tools that Colin's building with his company, BetScope, I think, stand a really good chance of sort of breaking through to more of a mass market audience, right? So that's one example, I guess, off the top of my head. There's 54 other ones I could give, but that one jumps out. And just a really clever guy building some really clever stuff.
Got it. And BetScope is like a arbitrage kind of spotting arbs, spotting outliers for odds and stuff.
Stuff like they'll say seeking value, I guess, more broadly. Yeah.
I'd say he's popular with bookies then. Good stuff. That's really interesting. And so one of the interesting things I saw the other day is, so there's a couple of things going on. So one is, like, obviously the world, the financial world and the markets in 2022 have completely changed, right? Mm-hmm. So Russia invades Ukraine, stock market takes a hit, inflation really takes off, interest rates are kicking in. So, you know, big tech firms are realized they've overhired during the COVID boom. And so there's big layoffs across tech. So the landscape's changed, right? So the world's changing. Money's more expensive. Investors are more sensitive, more focused on profit and stuff. How have you seen that change? Like, have you, because obviously you've been doing this for over a year, so you've kind of seen the pre and the post. How are you seeing things change with the startups, or like, how are you seeing that kind of gambling industry kind of startup ecosystem?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, our industry isn't unique. I mean, as you just pointed out, Fintan, like in the macro, every industry is struggling right now in different ways, and ours is no different. I think as it relates to the early stage part of the ecosystem and some of the, you know, people I've been talking to through the podcast, certainly it is more challenging than it was in 2020, 2021. But I also think that those particular years might be aberrations when you look back historically, right? Money was essentially free. It was flying around. Capital was plentiful. You know, investors were chasing all sorts of deals, in many cases, bad deals. In that environment, you know, oftentimes, and as we're now sort of seeing with things like FTX, right, in the crypto space, a lack of basic diligence was done with many of these companies, right? So I think what we've seen over the last sort of 6 to 8 to 12 months, I guess, as we're, I guess, correcting course here, is, you know, money is still available, capital is still available, but it really is now, I think, incumbent upon the entrepreneurs and the founders to really make sure not only do they have a believable story, but they actually have to produce results now, right? Have a story that's backed by metrics and KPIs and really, you know, allowing investors to do that diligence to have conviction in making an investment. And it's not a case of that there's no capital to be deployed anymore. On the contrary, I think I read something the other day saying that there's more sort of, you know, dry powder sitting on the sidelines waiting to be deployed than there's ever been in history, right? So it's not that there's a shortage of money to invest, but I think the sentiment from certainly the investors I've spoken with over the last number of months is that they are being more judicious in their approach and obviously requiring a lot more from the entrepreneurs to cut a check these days. So yeah, I mean, money isn't falling from the sky in the way it maybe was a year and a half, 2 years ago, but that's not a bad thing. And I think in our industry and within the ecosystem here, you know, good entrepreneurs and good companies doing good things are still raising money, right? Money is still being raised, but it just isn't maybe as plentiful and as free flowing as it once was.
Yeah, understood. And one of the stats, the Scott and Jake at Earnings and More, they track startups as well. And they had a tweet today, or part of the newsletter today, was saying that in 2022, funding for gaming related startups topped $250 million. And on one hand, that's a big number. But on another hand, as like a percentage of the gambling industry or like VC funding in general, it's actually tiny. So you realize like it's like a really tiny number overall. So this still, like, I think innovation in the space still feels like, you've done 50 episodes, right? So that's at least 50 startups plus another 4 months, right? So there's easily 100 startups out there.
Yeah.
So there's clearly lots of people, but it feels like there's not a lot of money floating around.
It's interesting you mentioned that. I saw that tweet the other day from them as well, and I hadn't quite, like, instinctively, I kind of felt that might be the case, but only until I saw them quantify it and produce that number of 250 million or whatever, did it really sort of hit home that, wow, like, you're right, Fintan, like, yes, a lot of money, but, you know, as a percentage of sort of the overall venture capital to be deployed across the entirety of the economy, it's basically a rounding error, actually, right? And I think for all of the, you know, all of the, I don't want to say sort of chest beating that we as an industry do about sort of the growth potential of it all, to me, that number really didn't seem commensurate with, I think, where we're at as an industry, and more importantly, where we're trying to get to. So I'm going to be personally interested to see what this year brings. You know, as well, one other interesting thing I think that I'm sort of anecdotally seeing and hearing a little bit of is, you know, some investors are maybe pulling back a little bit from the early stuff and maybe looking at trying to get involved in companies that are raising maybe their second or third round of funding that have been somewhat de-risked and have somewhat established some level of product market fit, right? So again, maybe it's I guess a diversion of some of the capital from that earliest stage to maybe like a seed or a series A type round where, you know, things are a little less risky than they might be in the earliest possible days. But you're right, Fintan, that number was to me shockingly low, right? And I don't know what to chalk that up to at this stage, but you know.
My guess would be some of it would be just it's the gambling industry and just people don't want to be involved and it's not sexy enough. And then I think as well, like when you look at startups in the space, there's a quite a common kind of trend as well. So like of the 50 odd podcasts, how many of them were an app where you can bet against your friends, right? I'm guessing there was a few. And when you look through the history of the gambling industry, like that's happened, like that idea has been tested loads of times and failed for various different reasons. And I'm not saying any of these guys couldn't succeed. I think potentially in America the world changes and moves on, and you can have a great idea and just really bad timing. I think that can absolutely happen, and I've personally experienced that. But you know, or like the arbitrage tools, or the, I don't know, glorified tipster, or then you've got the, you know, let's just slap on whatever the buzzword of today is, like machine learning, AI. So it'll be like generative AI will be the next thing, right? Or blockchain, or it was blockchain last month, but not anymore. And I think there is also a slight lack of innovation. But then I think the industry is really good at copying. Mm-hmm. So I always find the gambling industry is very unimaginative. But the second something works, they'll copy it really quickly. So things like cash out.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been able to cash out a bet early. I think Betfair or somebody had the lead on that for about 6 months, and then everybody had it, and then it's just like a standard feature. Or I think the next big one's going to be the micro betting with Better. If that works, like if their Ohio numbers look good, if you don't already have it on your product roadmap, it'll be on everybody's product roadmap, and everybody will have it by the next Super Bowl. And I think that also makes it really hard to innovate, because your competitors will, it's like trying to, you know, Facebook just copying your social media product into whatever, or Insta, you know, it's just like that cannibalization of the startups, I think, is actually makes it really, really tough.
Yeah, absolutely. Would agree with that. And, I guess, like, yeah, in the case of microblading being sort of the current one, if you will, you know, we are starting to see, I think, some of it, you know, I guess I'll back up. Like, last week, the episode of my podcast was actually with Joey Levy from Better, right? So kind of heard his comments on that and sort of hearing him tell the story of co-founding SimpleBet a few years ago, which was, you know, perhaps one of the first companies that really pioneered this concept of what we now know as microbetting. And, you know, his vision for that at the time was to have this be sort of a mass market product, and his answer to making what is otherwise a pretty clunky user experience more intuitive and maybe a bit more geared towards US sports as well. And just with the cadence of sort of the stop start flow of a US sporting game through American football and baseball, things like this. You know, it took him a number of years to, I think, really get that adoption. And only now, some number of years later, you know, SimpleBet signed a couple operators as clients. But it really takes getting that first or second one that see the vision and believe in it and buy into it. Yeah. And to your point, Fintan, I think then you see sort of a fast follower sort of dynamic at play where all of the others sort of see this and, you know, the floodgates are open at that point, right? So today it's microbetting. Tomorrow, who knows what it will be. But yeah, we've seen this play out, whether it be with Cash Out or Request a Bet a few years ago. Right. So yeah, it's a common dynamic. I would absolutely agree with that.
And how did you stumble into the gambling industry? What's your origin story?
Right. So the origin story in short is that, let's see here. How far back do we want to go to the origins here?
All the way back.
All right.
Yeah. What were you bitten by?
So look, I'm 41 years old now. When I was 17 here in Canada, I had my first job at a local grocery store where I was a jack of all trades, right? Everything from cleaning the butcher's equipment to taking out the trash to working the cashier till up at the front, you know, selling cigarettes to the local drunks, all of these things, right? Included within that here in British Columbia, the government has a monopoly on the lottery, BCLC. And as part of my work at this grocery store, I had to operate the lottery terminal, right? So people coming in to buy their ticket for the lottery, all good and well. I had to get sent to a 4-hour training course to learn how to use this lottery terminal at the age of 17, go to the, you know, turn up at the local hotel conference room and, you know, stale sandwiches out on the table, right? The classic thing. And I'm like, this is boring as hell. I'm just, you know, grinding my way through this 4-hour required training to learn how to use a lottery terminal, which I never asked to learn about. Then they get to the part where they're like, hey, there's a certain type of ticket you might be asked to write up here called called an odd set, which is basically a point spread ticket, right? So all of a sudden they introduce a sports betting product within the wider lottery product mix. And I perk up, right? I'm 17 years old, fan of sports. And I'm like, wait a minute, this is a whole new dynamic to a game, which I'd never understood before. So right away I said, wow, this is cool. Like, I'm really into this. Problem for me was that at the age of 17 in British Columbia, you can't actually buy one of these sports betting tickets, but I can sell them. So I would go back to work the next day, ring up a ticket in the machine, put my $2 in the till, and print off my own sports betting tickets, right? I think enough time has lapsed where I can admit this now. So I was selling myself my tickets from the age of 17, you know, turn 19 or 20, get my first credit card. And this is early 2000s at this point. I opened up my first online account, which was a very scary thing to do back then, and dealing with, you know, very foreign entities, both literally, sure, but also figuratively, like, I know who these people were. Opened up my first online account back then with Bowmans.com, which then went on to, you know, merge with Bet365. I've been betting online since the early 2000s. And here in Canada, being, you know, it's long been an unregulated market, we've had a plethora of options from a lot of the UK and European operators who do service the Canadian market. So I've actually had the opportunity to play, you know, with Betfair from the early days and Bet365 since the early 2000s. So I've had a lot of experience from the punter's perspective, sort of through my formative years in my 20s and early 30s. Fast forward to about 2010, and I was looking to start my first meaningful startup. And, you know, when I sort of thought about what it is I wanted to do, and again, 2010, like at the time, people didn't start startups as frequently as they do now, right? I mean, at that point, the iPhone had only been out for a couple of years. Like, even apps as a concept were relatively new. So this whole idea of, like, quitting your job to start a company at that time was a, you know, a fairly, like, novel concept. And when it came time for me to think about what it is I wanted to do, I really felt there to be a gap in the tools that were available to me as a punter or a bettor to be able to actually run some level of, like, sensible analysis before I actually make my bets. So in answer to your question, I put a team together. We raised a little bit of what's called angel investment at the time. I think it was about $350,000. and set out to basically build a software that allowed people to run analysis on trends within a match and then basically backtest them against historical matches and basically try and understand whether this trend has a profitable angle to it. The people on Twitter debate all day long whether this method of you know trends analysis is valid or not. That aside, we built some pretty neat stuff. We partnered with Optusport in London to build a soccer version of it. We partnered with Odds Checker to actually deploy a version of this tool on their sites, on their soccer page. So we spent like years of 2010 to 2015 really like fumbling our way into the industry. We didn't know a soul at the very beginning. So just chock full of like naivete and ignorance and didn't know what we didn't know. But we got out there. You know, I went to my first ICE conference, I think, in 2010, back when it was at Earl's Court still. And we just really tried to make a good old-fashioned go of it, right? Getting out there, trying to learn, trying to talk to people, get feedback, pitching our concepts, iterating based on that feedback. Ultimately, we didn't really establish what I would call product market fit with that product, largely because in retrospect, we were just way too early. So you talked a few minutes ago, Fenton, just about timing of everything. And we were just way too early is what it was. I do, you know, believe fairly strongly, you know, if it was 5 years ago instead of 12 years ago, it'd be a much different outcome. But that all being said, we had a really amazing journey. We worked with a lot of the top brands and operators around the world. So, you know, William Hill in Gibraltar, we were in Jib a few times, worked with Bwin, we're out in their offices in Vienna a couple times, and really just getting that experience, right? So we just grinded and hustled and like really scrapped. Like it's a really like unsexy, like old fashioned story of startups. And about 5 years in, we concluded that we weren't ever going to sort of become a unicorn to the extent we cared about becoming a unicorn. But we also weren't really building what I would call like an interesting business. So we got a little bit fatigued, I guess we'll say. And we had an opportunity in 2015 with one of our clients, which happened to be an operator called Pinnacle Sports. And we flew down to their head office on an island called Curaçao in the Caribbean in 2015. And spent a week there, went and met up with Paris, the CEO, and by the end of that week, we had a handshake deal for Pinnacle to acquire our company and basically bring all of our IP that we had developed into Pinnacle. But, you know, probably as importantly, or maybe more importantly, bring sort of the key team members of my company into Pinnacle. And we did just that. So, yeah, long-winded answer to a simple question, Fenton. But origin story, did the thing that I'm talking to all of these people, did all of that about 10, 12 years ago. And, you know, using a baseball metaphor, it certainly the outcome wasn't a home run. It was something like a line drive to center field or something like that. But it was a great outcome. And then I spent 6 years with Pinnacle, which is a separate chapter, of course. But, you know, just an experience I wouldn't change for the world. And certainly, you know, coming back to, I guess, the startup ecosystem now, some 10 or 12 years later in the same industry, it's just obviously a whole different world now, right? I mean, the post-PASPA era and just the barriers to entry for startups are extremely low now. The cost to start something is extremely low now. So it's just a much different world, but an exciting one. And yeah, just the podcast has given me a good excuse to sort of wedge myself into it and talk to these people doing all these interesting things.
Fantastic. And I think it's like, if you kind of compare like a startup 10, 12 years ago to today, like some of the, just the tech advantages.
Mm.
So things like cloud hosting and like AWS or just, you know, I don't know, the quality of talent available on Upwork to just do whatever you need done, or there's so many like, oh wow, it's really easy to like, you don't have to go buy a server or like, just like, I don't need to worry about hosting or like, there's so much where you just, it's so much easier these days. Based on, obviously, you know, we look back at our younger selves, and I think if you're not embarrassed by your younger self, you should be worried. Like if you were to go back and do your startup journey again, based on what you know today, what would you do different?
It's a good question. So I came into this from the perspective of the customer problem, right? So again, we were originally building tools for punters because I, as a punter, perceived a gap. Right? There was a gap at the time. Mm. What I didn't do, and I guess perhaps what my younger self hadn't fully thought through, is what does the business side of this look like? What is this industry that we're entering into? And I didn't have a real grasp on that, right? I really came at it from the customer perspective, not the industry perspective. And I learned a lot of lessons along the way there about, you know, some assumptions maybe I had that were very quickly dispelled, and just huge gaps that I didn't know what I had, right? You don't know what you don't know when you're young and foolish. And that was basically it for me. So I think, you know, maybe having done a little bit more investigative work, some analysis on this industry, where is it at, where is it going? We just jumped in without even looking, right? So for better or for worse, but you know, to do it all again and maybe, not having the energy and maybe some of the naivety I did 10 years ago, I would certainly make sure that whatever I'm jumping into now is a lot more calculated and thoughtful than maybe it was back then.
No, I get that. But there's also, you need that naivety to, otherwise you just wouldn't start either, right? So there's also, it's always the balance of, if you overthink it, you're never going to start. You've got to just have that little bit of not stupidity, but that kind of just like, let's do it. I understand.
Yeah, I always sort of characterize it as like blind ambition, right? I'm like, I know I want to do this, I'm up for it, but I don't know what I'm getting into, and that's okay. We'll just figure it out along the way here. So
that's how I've lived my life. I completely get it. You've also got another venture. So apart from the fantastic podcast, which everyone should obviously listen to, tell us about your other venture.
Cool. So with the podcast is maybe sort of the focus of my year last year. Concurrently to that, I started building a platform. So getting into a bit of a technology project more so than just a content or media type project with the podcast. And I guess just to give a quick origin story on that. So a little over a year ago, I'd mentioned that I spent 6 years with Pinnacle on the operator side. And wow, what an experience that was. But I left Pinnacle in September of 2021. And I just recognized that, you know, I'd been there 6 years, time for a change. Obviously, all of our brains were rattled post-COVID and, you know, having all these existential crises of which I was not immune. So, jumped out onto my own, started the podcast. But, you know, I knew I wanted to stay within the industry. I knew I wanted to stay within the space. It's the devil I know, for better or for worse. And one thing that was very fresh on my mind coming out of Pinnacle was, as part of my remit there, I had something like 80 something full-time employees under my remit across a number of functional areas. So all that to say, what that meant in practical terms is that I was spending a lot of my time going through the hiring process and the recruiting process and the talent acquisition process. And once I left Pinnacle, I'm like, wow, like that is really broken in this industry. It's broken in a lot of industries, frankly, but you know, we're hearing all of these stories about employers that can't fill requisitions as fast as the managers are sending them to HR. Talent acquisition teams are overstretched. They can't fill key roles, blah, blah, blah. And I really recognized, I think, that there was a gap in the market. So I guess what I wanted to do is, you know, try a little project, which has since sort of blossomed into something more than that. And the basic premise of it is that basically just a job board for the betting and iGaming industry, right? There's no place right now, and this includes LinkedIn, this includes the aggregator sites like Indeed or Monster or whatever the other ones are, Glassdoor. All of these sites don't necessarily contain the entirety of sort of the jobs available within our industry. So I set out to build a simple little premise of a job board for the industry where I'm aggregating as many jobs as I can possibly find from as many employers as I can possibly find in the industry. And I really just wanted a one-stop shop for the industry's jobs to exist and live in one place. So yeah, I've been building that out quietly over the past year, I guess. And in the last few months, I've soft launched it. So shameless plug here, bettingroles.com, R-O-L-E-S. Bettingroles.com is where you can find what is a pretty rickety MVP right now, but it is live. And I guess I should start talking about it at some point. So here we are. And the premise is, yeah, it's a job board for the betting industry. If you are a job seeker, there's some free tools there that you would expect on any of these types of websites, but basically free tools to help you, discover who the employers are in the industry, help you, you know, follow the employers and obviously, make it easy for people to find interesting roles within this industry, of which there's lots. Even in the face of a gloomy macro outlook right now, there's still a ton of jobs available. There's still employers struggling to fill requisitions. So we're making it easy for people to find what I say their dream role in the betting industry. Very quickly, just to round out the pitch here, which I haven't ever practiced or verbalized before, Fintan. So this is a dry run. Go easy on me.
Go for it.
On the employer side, I'm very much thinking about this as a, I guess what I'm calling a recruitment marketing tool. So in the same way that any organization anywhere gives their marketing teams tools to acquire customers, in most organizations, talent acquisition teams, whose role is to acquire talent to organizations, aren't given similar types of tools as marketing teams, right? So they really struggle. I'm very much positioning this to them as a recruitment marketing tool. It's something that allows them to get their employer brand out there and sort of talk about their employer brand in their own voice. Obviously, we're aggregating all of the jobs, so we're making it easy for their jobs to get discovered. More importantly, yeah, giving these employers some tools to really hopefully add another, channel to their funnel for talent acquisition. So that's the high concept pitch right now. It's a job board for the industry, but nothing like that exists to my knowledge so far. I mean, certainly people post jobs and there's some, mini aggregators, I would call it. But as far as something that has the, ambition to literally aggregate every single job in the industry and sort of have that data set of all of the jobs, that's really what we're building out here. And a lot of vision for where it could go. But for now, really just focus on getting sort of the nuts and bolts organized and getting a little bit of traction here, hopefully in the coming months.
Fantastic. Because I've been playing around with it. So like the filtering of like marketing, and then you just all the marketing jobs or VIP or CRM, and just saying, okay, here's everything that's out there right now. I thought it was really cool.
Cool.
Yeah, super useful.
Yeah. So early days, again, I'm very much just calling it a project right now. I think obviously it probably has the potential to grow on something, you know, more resembling a business, but for now it's a project. And it will take a lot of my focus over the coming months here. I'm slowly starting to, I'm not saying that I'm leaving the podcast, but I am saying that now that I reached my goal of 50 episodes, I am starting to think about scalability on that side and how can I free up a lot of my time that goes into the operational side of it right now. Right. So we talked a little while ago, just about sort of the preparation, of which I do quite a bit. You know, I think for interviewing my guests, I really want to feel prepared and be able to ask them questions that are relevant and contextual to what they're up to, which requires some level of research and all of that stuff, right? But man, that takes a lot of time. And I didn't really have an appreciation for that. And my reward to myself for getting to 50 episodes is to hopefully hire a coordinator soon to take a lot of that off my desk and free up my time to focus on the job site over the coming months ahead here. So a lot of irons in the fire. I got a few others in the oven as well, slowly baking. But as a guy with a lack of focus, I guess that's permeating through the microphone right now.
We're the same in terms of preparation. And it's exhausting.
It's all we do.
Some days I might nap 2-3 times.
I mean, you don't want to rush these things, John.
But that's perfectionism comes at a price, I find.
It's a great question. Actually, here's a great last question for you, for Jesse. What questions should we have asked you that we didn't?
Oh, yeah. Let's get some tips.
Yeah. What should we do?
Some tips. I don't know. Well, I'm assuming John's going to ask about Cobra Kai in a little bit here, so I'm not going to preempt the answer to that one. I don't have a good answer to that, guys. Actually asked that question to a few of my guests in earlier episodes at the end. I said, hey, well, you know, if I forgot to ask you something, what would that question have been and what would your answer have been? And that's summed to everybody I asked. So I actually stopped asking that question, and I feel very unprepared to answer that here now. So
That's fine.
Well, I mean, my answer would have been, if you were a kitchen utensil, what would you be and why? Fenton, let's ask you that one first. If you're a kitchen utensil, what would it be?
I would be the coffee machine.
I didn't say appliance. I said utensil.
Technicality.
I would be a big spoon. Because I'm the big spoon.
Fenton wears the trousers in his
marriage. Even when I'm the little spoon.
Cut in the color.
Even when I'm the little spoon, it's just her strapping herself on. It's all psychology.
Jesse, what utensil would you be?
I'd probably be the bottle opener.
Nice. Power move.
There we go.
Power move.
Everybody needs one. Everybody loves them.
Yeah, because when you need it, you really need it.
That's right.
Really, I need a bottle opener right now.
Now, don't make me use my teeth. Yeah.
Again. What would you be, John?
I think I'd be a spatula.
Just because you like the word? Or
basically, yes. It's in my top 5 favorite words. It's probably number 2 after bingo.
Bingo is your favorite word?
It is, yeah. Because I like etymology. I like looking at words, hearing words in different languages, or seeing words in English and figuring out their potential origins. And my favorite one is there's an English town called Weston-super-Mare. It's a shit name for a town. I mean, Weston-super-Mare. Anybody that's been there knows there is nothing super about it and there are no lady horses. Why is it called that? It's from French. It's Weston-sur-la-Mer. So that's a nice example of some relatively easy things to work out. But bingo, where the fuck did that come from? And also, it's a great joke in the first Naked Gun movie. Leslie Nielsen's rooting through, I think it's, what's his name? Khan's desk. Ricardo Montalban's desk. And he opens the door and he just goes, bingo. And pulls out a bingo card. It's a great moment. I think maybe it probably works better visually.
It's definitely a visual joke.
I was going to say. Coming back to your spatula utensil there for a minute, it actually made me think as you were saying that. I don't know if you saw the film, I'm sure you did, from years ago, UHF, I think it was in the 80s, with Weird Al Yankovic.
Fuck yeah.
And Spatula Fantastic. City.
Remember that?
Spatula
a
City.
Little scene move. You have no idea how much I laughed at that. And it's UHF, not many people in the UK have seen that movie. And it's a phenomenal film. Badgers? We don't need no stinking badgers. It's a great movie. And I'm looking forward to the Weird Al movie that Daniel Radcliffe has just done. That looks like a lot of fun. So I was thinking, Jesse, this is a question for everybody here. Who are your top five Canadians?
Top five.
Don't have to be in order, but if they are in order, you get a bonus point.
Five. We couldn't go with three.
You must know five people, Jesse.
Well, I certainly know five people. Top five Canadians. Well, let's go with ones that might have some familiarity to people that might be listening.
Fuck that. Just come up with the best five Canadians.
Well, look, hard not to include somebody like Terry Fox near the top of that list. Right?
We're both big fans. I sent Fintan a book about Terry Fox that Douglas Coupland did.
Actually live where I live in Canada here. So we have the Trans-Canada Highway, which spans the entirety of the country, which is massive, clearly.
Yeah.
But at one end of it is called Mile Zero, and that happens to be where I live on the West Coast. So just down the road from where I live is Mile Zero of the Trans-Canada Highway, and the commemoration there is a huge bronze statue of Terry, which is very cool. And if I'm out doing my 5K run, I always run by Terry. Yeah, so it's a nice reminder. Hard not to include him near the top of any list of top Canadians.
No, I think that's very fair. Very, very fair. I'm a huge fan of Terry Fox, and I've been talking on and off for a couple of years with people about putting some Terry Fox runs on in the UK because the family have worked out how to do it in the UK. It's a funny thing because you don't want to say to people raising funds for cancer research in Canada, but because of the way that the charity works, the Terry Fox Foundation actually provides funding for research, which is an international thing. And so they've basically said that money that's raised in the UK can go to UK research foundations, etc., which is pretty interesting. Anybody that's listening who doesn't know who Terry Fox is a young Canadian man who in the
1981, 1970s,
I think.
Or maybe late 70s even.
As late as 81. No, I think you're probably right. Decided, having had a very aggressive form of cancer in his knee, a type of blastoma in his knee, had his leg amputated above the knee. His right leg, wasn't it? And he decided, you know what, fuck this. If we all chip in a bit, we can cure cancer. And I love that. I love that. It's, some people might describe such a view as arrogance. I don't. Some people just don't see barriers. And I love the thing I love most about Terry Fox is that vision. They did it without any media backing. They did it without any money. His brother and a friend and him, they had a camper van. Terry started out running a marathon a day, basically. across Canada, which let's not forget is what, the second largest landmass in the world, second largest country in the world.
That's right.
And he made it 3,339 miles, if I remember correctly, before he couldn't carry on anymore. It turned out his cancer had metastasized and he was running with two rather large tumors in his lungs. But just what a geezer. What a geezer.
Well, and now here, 40 years later, right? 40 years on since then, at least here in Canada, right? Every year there's, it's called the Marathon for Hope, right? So in every community across the country, it is sort of in his name. Everybody does the Terry Fox Marathon for Hope. And it's a huge, probably the largest single fundraiser for cancer research within Canada anyway, every year. And 40 years on, I mean, what a legacy, right?
Yeah, that's amazing, legacy.
It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And also, across Canada, I believe most places have a road named after him. There is a Mount Terry Fox as well, but let's face it, Canada does have quite a lot of mountains. And some really beautiful statues and sort of little commemorations here and there. I think there's something at mile 3,339 as well. But you've still got four Canadians to go.
You're not getting out that easy.
Christ.
I'll give you a little bit of inspiration. I'll give you my top five Canadians.
All right, let's go.
So I've got Jesse Learmonth.
Yeah, solid.
I've got Earl Hall, friend of the podcast.
Big friend of the podcast.
Brad Broderick. Brad's never been on, but he is one of the two best dressed men in the gambling industry. Okay.
That's a big claim.
He's the, director of operations for Carnival. For their cruise ship casinos. Honestly, he really dresses beautifully. Really does dress beautifully. And I mean, they're also lovely people. There's a few little outliers here. Leslie Nielsen, who we have in fact already mentioned. Douglas Coupland, who we've also already mentioned. It's a Canada heavy podcast. David Cronenberg, who actually came up in a conversation I had earlier today. Terry Fox is my number one favorite Canadian. But I'm also going to throw Sticky Henderson in there as well. Do you know a band called Weeping Tile?
I do not.
Do you know Sarah McLachlan?
Sarah McLachlan, we do know here, yes.
Okay, so Sarah McLachlan used to be in a band called Weeping Tile.
Okay.
With Sticky Henderson. Sticky Henderson's, in fact, I think Sarah McLachlan's first album had a song on it called Lodestar. It's a really beautiful song. That's a Weeping Tile song. The Weeping Tile version is incredible. Sticky Henderson, when she left Weeping Tile, formed a band called Ass Machine, which have been mentioned on this podcast before.
They have.
And Sticky Henderson,
more than you'd expect.
Sticky Henderson is in my top five favorite Canadians because I found two of their CDs in a Canadian secondhand record store, and they posted them. Their service was just lovely. I mean, you know, they're Canadian. And I couldn't find the first album anywhere, and this stuff's not available digitally. I know that's shocking. And I'd had a conversation with Sticky Henderson on YouTube where she was posting some videos, some old Weeping Tile videos and stuff, and Ass Machine. And so I said, look, where can I find this? I don't know where to get it. Can I buy this? Have you got the MP3s? Can I buy the files off you? And she's like, well, I'll send you the CD. And like, she didn't accept any payment or anything like that. She just sent me the CD. Just fabulous. You know, she was just, as well as being a talented singer and bass player in her own right, former member of Weeping Tile, she's, you know, in my top five Canadians.
Wow.
Good old Sticky Henderson. You would think with a name like Sticky, though, she'd have been the drummer, but she wasn't.
You would think she'd be the drummer.
Now, if you want to get into a list of the most awful Canadians, I mean that's a fun list too, right? We can start to get into people like Justin Bieber, the singer from the band Nickelback. There's a long list of potential most awful Canadians, so I rank them quite highly on that list.
There was a lady. She used to do the reception desk at QVC in the UK, and she had a genuine obsession with Bryan Adams.
Mm.
And unfortunately for Bryan, this was when he lived in London, which I think he might still do. I don't know. But he was living in London and working as a photographer, which he obviously did for quite a while. But she was fucking obsessed. I swear she knew where he was every minute of the day. It was, God, how the hell did I get onto her? Her name was Margaret. She was a lovely lady. Yeah, weird. People get obsessed with Canadians. Fintan, top five Canadians.
I've got no strong opinions on this. I quite like Ryan Reynolds. I think he's good.
So that's a good shout, actually.
His quality of work, but not just like, obviously the movie, like things like Deadpool was just brilliant. But then the Aviation Gin, the football club, the Netflix series around it, like just his...
The series is fantastic.
His kind of three, like from a marketing perspective, his 360 marketing is just on point. And he's like a benchmark, because you've got somebody like The Rock who does something very similar, but I think just Ryan Reynolds is just far more entertaining.
I think Clooney's probably on a similar level.
Not quite. I don't think his social media is as strong.
But he has done a very similar...
They've got the drinks. He's got the drinks. Thing. Yeah, they got the drinks and they've got this stuff. But I think Ryan Reynolds, the self awareness and the, you know, making fun of himself as part of it, I think resonates really well. But it's probably just more about my personality.
It's probably also worth including on a list like this Michael J. Fox as well, now that I'm thinking about it a little bit here.
Oh, that's a terrific shout. That is a good shout. Because the thing about Michael J. Fox is, apart from everything that he's done in the last several years, which, you know, my uncle died with Parkinson's, and I learned more from reading Michael J. Fox's books about Parkinson's than anything else, more even than talking to my uncle. It was such a massive education, because he's a lovely writer, fundamentally. He makes it really easy to read it and learn about it. But also, when you think about his best movies, he reached a point where he's almost like a global treasure. And I know that probably sounds like an odd thing to say, but there's a term in the UK which is probably used elsewhere as well. But you know, somebody becomes a national treasure. Yeah. Stephen Fry, for example, is a famous English national treasure. Stephen Fry is a national treasure. Hugh Laurie, not so much. A little bit, but not so much. So it's God knows how you qualify to be one. But Michael J. Fox, I would say, is an international treasure.
All right,
beloved around the world.
Let's do it then. Favorite Michael J. Fox movie? You're only allowed to pick one.
Ooh. Wow, that is difficult. Okay. Doc Hollywood.
I'm going to go with Teen Wolf.
No way. That's because it resonates with your own hirsute self.
It does. It does. As a young man, I felt seen. I felt represented on screen. Finally.
It's very important. Fintan, if you can see it, you can be it. Jesse.
Well, I'll just take Back to the Future, right? I mean.
Yeah, of course.
Why not?
Of course. It was a
Marty McFly
institution.
It is pretty fabulous. Is Michael? I'm gonna have to look this up now. Hang on. I'm just looking up to see if his dad on Family Ties is a Canadian.
Oh,
no, born in Chicago.
Classic show as well.
He would have been there, you know. Mm. But there's probably some other good. But Michael J. Fox. That is a great shout. That is.
Yeah.
Lordy. And I'm sure we've missed off some great Canadians, but I stand by Brad Broderick, Earl Hall, and Jesse Learmonth.
Honored to be included, John. Thank you.
It's okay. You also, Jesse, you have a very similar name to a top British, admittedly female, triathlete.
Which I learned.
She's a Jess.
Which I learned only because, you know, you do the thing once a year where you Google your own name just to kind of see what comes up. And I did it 1 year and all of a sudden this lady sort of jumped all of my results on Google. And it's exactly as you say, John, this female triathlete from the UK, I believe. Jesse Learmonth. So shout out to Jesse. Yeah.
She is very, very good. There's no getting around. I'm a big fan of hers and yours. So, I mean, I'm covering a lot of bases there. I'm also now Googling myself. Do you do it in speech marks when you do it?
You can do.
Okay, there's my Twitter one. That's at the top. And then LinkedIn second. And there's... Oh, yeah, I don't do that anymore.
Oh, I like the old headshot photos. Look at this.
Ones with hair?
No, just chunkier.
Yeah, there's a lot of me, wasn't there?
It's a lot to cuddle.
There's a lot to love. But if you do mine without the speech marks on it,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot.
Yeah.
457,000 results. And I tell you why I bring this up, right? My surname is highly unusual. Like, I found a tool online once and it showed you the concentration of people with your name in the world. And there were about like 37 of us. And I'm related to most of them.
What?
Okay. It's a very, very unusual surname. But in prog rock band Yes, they had a drummer called Bill Bruford. And I think the other dude might have been a singer, a guy called John Anderson, who spelled his name J-O-N. So when you put John and Bruford into a search engine, you come up with an awful lot of Yes, basically. It's not terribly exciting.
I think that's the signal to wrap this up, mate.
We reached the end, right?
That's a good shout. Sorry, chaps. But just before we go, Cobra Kai, your thoughts. What is your spiritual dojo and have you seen it all?
Have not seen it all. I probably haven't seen anything like it since the original Karate Kid back in the 80s. So I have some work to do here on the Cobra Kai side of it. I know.
You do.
Yeah, and it's the second time we've asked you that question as well. You think
he could come back more prepared this time.
He's had months.
He talks a lot about prep work and really trying, and, you know, it's a lot of stuff. And then, boom, we catch him out with Cobra.
Well, I fear now that's going to now exclude me from John's list of favorite Canadians, potentially.
Well, let's just say it's become a top
asterisk.
Six.
There's an asterisk.
But Fenton... That's that investigative journalism I was telling you about the other week.
Yeah, it just kicks into you. Bloodhound, that's what you're. Bloodhound.
I've got a mind like a steel trap.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, it's been left out for many, many years.
Rusty and squeaky.
Yeah, doesn't move, even when you stand on it. Jesse Learmonth, thank you so much for joining us.
Appreciate it.
And, you know, come back when you've watched Cobra Kai.
Okay.
But good luck with the podcast, with the new project, and with, you know, with all of your finger pies.
Appreciate you having me, gents. And we'll do this again soon.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You can find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just at Gambling Files. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share, tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.